So, thank you so much for the 3-month sabbatical that you granted me from July through September. The best part of my time away was our family trip to Europe, and we spent 5 days in Munich and then traveled to Switzerland and spent 5 days in Lauterbrunnen, Switzerland. One day we took a cog train up to Mount Jungfraujoch. And we had the privilege of walking on the Aletsch Glacier that covers about 30 square miles and has the thickness of 1 kilometer. We could hear it cracking when we were out there. It made me a little nervous. So at 11,300 feet above sea level, I had a deeper understanding of the word breathtaking. Frequently, I had to stop to catch my breath, and at times I wondered if I'd ever make it out to this destination that was at the end of this path, but I did. So I'll show you some pictures. So this is us climbing this long path, which doesn't look steep there, but it was so steep. It was tough. I had to stop so frequently to catch my breath, and then the next picture. You just keep going and going and going, and I swear they kept moving that destination. And then looking when we finally got there, this is a perspective of people coming up to the destination. So yeah, it was quite a hike, and we made it, and it was just so beautiful. So the vistas, of course, were awe-inspiring, and at some point you just go, well, just put your camera down. Like, why am I going to keep trying to take pictures of this? Mother Nature showering us with spectacular beauty. And it was such a gift to behold, and our family will never forget it. So when we finished walking, we returned to the building that has this, you know, huge, it was the main building, and it had this huge viewing area and an ice palace and shops and restaurants. And so we were a bit tired and cold, so we got a cup of coffee and some treats while we waited to get up back on the train to go back down. And as I looked around, I was like, oh, there are all these crowds and crowds of people, all at the top of Europe. So feeling a bit put off by all of these people, I said, wow, there's so many tourists here. And then I realized I was one of those tourists. I might as well have said, wow, there is so many of me here. So the temptation, though, to define myself as separate from all of these tourists showed up almost without conscious thought. Yet I couldn't have been more like them. I desired what they desired to be at the top of this mountain. We were all at the top of Europe. In the passage in Luke, we are given insight into our human nature, this tendency we all have to want to define ourselves as different from others. The first sentence of this story immediately gets my attention. I know what. Jesus says, Jesus told this story to some who trusted themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. I know what Jesus is talking about here because I know myself. Jesus gives the example of a religious leader who is filled with gratitude because he claims not to be like other people. This person defines his own perceived goodness by comparing himself to people who are bad and then admiring the distance he sees between himself and others. Now, interestingly, the passage doesn't say that Jesus is surprised by this behavior. He seems to know that this is just part of our human condition and wants us to be aware of it. Like so many stories by Jesus, he first explains a facet of our human condition, and then he invites us to behave a new way. So in the Beatitudes, we see this a lot. Instead of repaying evil for evil, Jesus says not to resist an evildoer. Instead of only loving our neighbor, we are to also love our enemies. And in this story, Jesus says, don't pray like this. Instead, pray like this. Jesus' desire is that we rise up out of this self-inflicted rivalry and our notions of self-righteousness and discover a new way to be good. So we are to be people who ask for mercy. Because as God fills us with mercy, our lives in turn ooze with mercy. Now, maybe we wouldn't be as bold to say this kind of prayer that the Pharisee offered, but I think we know of times when we have entertained similar notions, times of comparing ourselves to others in order to feel better about who we are. For instance, I wonder if the 21st century version of this prayer by the Pharisee might be the statement, I'm spiritual but not religious. When we say this, what is it that we're trying to communicate? Who are we trying to distance ourselves from when we use this phrase? Can we see how this leads to an us versus them mentality? Again, Jesus is not surprised by our human desires to describe ourselves over and against others. He names it, and without labeling it as good or bad, it just is. Instead, he shares how we are to face that about ourselves. His solution is prayer. And I love this. Jesus invites us to change through the act of prayer. Jesus doesn't give us a 10-step method to rid ourselves of this behavior. Jesus doesn't tell us to simply try harder and think harder, and this tendency will go away. And very importantly, Jesus doesn't shake his finger at the Pharisee or us and say, you bad person, you bad people. Jesus, our rabbi still, invites us to change through prayer. And it is a simple one-sentence prayer. So he says, when these creeping notions arise in us, that temptation to define ourselves as separate from others, we are to pray, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That's it. That's it. But as simple as this prayer is, it can accomplish so much. By praying this, we remember who we are and whose we are. By praying this, we remember that we are always in the process of being forgiven, which drives us deeper into following the desires of Jesus and forgiving others. This prayer leads us away from the cycle of violence and into the cycle of forgiveness. So from this story and throughout the Gospels, I find the following themes in Jesus' teachings. Number one, we have this human propensity that leads us to be in rivalry with others, where we define ourselves as different and separate from others, which can create an us versus them mentality. Second, from this, we're lured into this false identity based on how we see ourselves as different than others. And third, Jesus' life, death, and resurrection draws us into a new identity, always. It causes us to see that God's love is non-rivalrous. God's love is not revengeful. It's not hateful, and therefore it is not involved in the cycle of violence in any way. And last, as God's love sinks deeper into us, it brings about a collapse of our own identity because we stop defining ourselves over and against others. It is a process by which we find ourselves learning who we are in the degree to which we discover a similarity with others, which can be very painful. It will feel like a loss of identity, a collapse of identity, and it will feel profoundly destabilizing. I was deeply challenged by Allison's ideas, and in particular, this phrase in his book, The Forgiving Victim, that he uses often. He talks about this collapse of identity, and that really pierced my innermost being. Using an old religious word, I felt convicted, and here's why. I have a family member who I've struggled with for decades, someone who has been very difficult to be with, someone for whom I've felt intense feelings of dislike and sometimes hatred. Throughout the years, our other family members would gather together, and we'd spend a good amount of time talking about our dislike for this other family member, and this felt really, really good. We had a common enemy, and this gave us an identity that made us feel close to each other. Well, learning from Jesus, our rabbi still, I saw how my own self-righteousness continued to cause hurt and pain. Reading James Allison's understanding about the meaning of the death and resurrection of Jesus woke me up to seeing my relationship and how I was perpetuating a cycle of animosity and disdain toward this family member. The description that Allison shared of a collapse identity of my identity was terrifying to me. Who would I be if I no longer identified this person as an enemy? Who would I be if I no longer identify this person as my enemy? I wish it was as easy as pushing a reset button, but it was not. Letting go of my tightly held beliefs about this person was extremely difficult to do. Yet it made sense that Jesus, my rabbi still, would be moving me in this direction. To move towards reconciliation was to follow the desires of Jesus. I love the placement of these two stories in Luke, the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector, and then the story of Jesus welcoming children. The simple prayer uttered by the tax collector is exactly what Jesus means by entering God's kingdom like a child. As we utter this prayer, we sense and recognize our vulnerability and our need for God. Entering God's kingdom is about living in this non-violent, non-rivalrous love of God. Recently, I was watching a PBS show that was about the Himalayas, and they also highlighted, of course, Mount Everest. One of the final statements made in that show was this statement: Mount Everest is still in the process of being created. Now, of course, that makes sense and something we all know, but for some reason, that statement caught my attention, and it gave me joy. And I thought about us as humans and how this understanding certainly applies to all of us. We are all still in the process of being created. And through the gifts of mercy and forgiveness from God, we continue to grow and change. We continue to sink deeper into the desires of Jesus, desires that lead us away from rivalry and hatred and revenge and violence, and moves us toward reconciliation and new life. Always, that is the push of the gospel. Those are the desires of Jesus. We are all indeed in the process of still being created. My hope is that we find ways to learn from our rabbi, the one who invites us to emulate his ways, to embrace his desires, to seek the path of mercy and forgiveness and see what unfolds. Jesus, our rabbi still. Amen.